Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Benjamin Hale, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book, The Wild and the Wicked, on Nature and Human Nature, is just out from the MIT Press. Many environmentalists approach the problem of motivating environmentally friendly behavior from the perspective that nature is good and that we ought to act so as to maximize the good environmental consequences of our actions and minimize the bad ones. An environmental activist turned academic philosopher, Hale argues against this dominant consequentialist approach towards environmentalism in favor of a Kantian view. We ought to act in environmentally friendly ways because it is the right thing to do. Hale argues that nature is not good, it is often bad, but that the Kantian position shows why we should have good reason to act to preserve nature, whether or not it is good. On his view, environmentally friendly action is motivated by reflecting on our reasons for acting, guided by a concern that our actions be acceptable to a wide range of parties. In this accessible discussion, intended for a wide audience, Hale provides a fresh philosophical grounding for thinking about human action and inaction regarding the environment. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Benjamin Hale. Are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to our discussion, The Wild and the Wicked on Nature and Human Nature, which is a very interestingly written and interestingly argued defense of basically a Kantian environmentalism, you know, where you emphasize, you know, we should act in certain ways that are environmentally friendly, because essentially that's the reasonable thing to do. We should leverage our human reasoning resources in order to promote activities that respect, or at least maybe that's not the right word, but promote the health of the planet and the environment. Now, you yourself also discuss it in the beginning, at least in the introduction to the book, that you have a history of being an environmental activist as well as a philosopher. So before we get into the book itself, maybe you can tell us a bit about your background and how you came to philosophy and how you came to write the book.
I will definitely do that. I do want to say, though, thank you for the introduction. I think you did a nice job of summarizing the book, and you're correct that it's primarily a Kantian justification for environmentalism, which is somewhat unusual within the environmental literature. So hopefully I can clarify why I sort of took that path and my justifications or reasons for writing the book in the first place. But I guess I should start just by sort of like giving a rough history of my intellectual maturation, if you will, and how I came to become not just a Kantian environmentalist, but ultimately an environmentalist and environmental philosopher. I mean, sort of long story short, I mean, I think like many people who enter the philosophy literature, I wasn't initially drawn to philosophy. I didn't know anything about it. I went to the college and I had all sorts of other kinds of interests. I was interested in chemistry and art and Russian. And so during my college time, I studied a lot of Russian and I studied a lot of art and I moved to Russia during my sophomore year of college and spent some time there just as the Soviet Union was falling apart. And I also, while there, started reading a lot of philosophy, and I'd taken a few classes in college. And I really was drawn to philosophy at that point, and particularly political theory and ethical theory. I spent the remainder of my 2 years in college sort of studying philosophy and continuing with a little bit of the art and the Russian. So much so that by the end of my 4 years, I applied for a fellowship to study art in Russia, all the while thinking that I would sort of take a more theoretical look at the sort of the life of the Soviet artist or the former Soviet artist in the face of the fall of the Soviet Union. So I got this fellowship to study in Russia, and I moved there in 1994, just after graduating from college, and lived there sort of alone in the dark in the winter where it was very cold. And I did a lot of thinking and a lot of reading. I read a lot of fiction and I read a lot of nonfiction, a lot of philosophy. But I also was paying attention to the political scene there. And what I witnessed, or what I was sort of witnessed through watching the news, was, you know, sort of the rise of the oligarchs and the sort of the rampant, the wholesale devastation of the Russian wilderness, you know, in the name of basically building up the country after the fall of the Soviet Union. I it sort of dawned on me at this point, and this maybe is late for a lot of people, but for me it was a revelation that so many of our wars and so much political strife is rooted in essentially a struggle for resources. And I don't know, something during that year kind of clicked where I recognized suddenly resources natural resources are environmental objects or things in the environment. And so during that time, I made a decision to pursue a kind of an unconventional path. I knew that I wanted to get a degree in philosophy. I was compelled to do that, but also a little bit afraid of moving into philosophy, knowing the job market even then was pretty terrible. And so I decided I would get a degree in environmental policy and natural resources policy. And I did that first, which I think was a very smart move for me. So I moved to Arizona. I got a master's degree, an MPA, master's in public administration in natural resources policy at the University of Arizona. And I learned a lot about how policy is made, what kinds of techniques and methods are used to justify policies. I learned a lot of environmental economics. And that I think probably more than a lot of the philosophy that I was later to read influenced my thinking about environmental issues. Also at that time, though, while I was in Arizona, I kind of hooked up with a bunch of environmental activists and you know, fairly radical activists. I hooked up with some folks in the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, which is a fairly aggressive environmental conservation organization that orients a lot of its work around trying to conserve species by essentially exploiting the Endangered Species Act and holding companies and industry to account for laws that are already on the books. And they are very, very successful in doing this. I saw what they were doing. I thought this was phenomenal. And I started attending protests and attending Forest Service hearings and eventually went to work at the Natural Resources Division of the Library of Congress and went to a couple of markup hearings. And what I witnessed during that time was not only a kind of battle between environmentalists and non-environmentalists or anti-environmentalists, but also a kind of a failure of discourse, a failure of these political actors to really take into consideration the arguments of people who were genuinely concerned about the plight of, you know, the ferruginous pygmy owl or the jaguar or whatever species was under question. So that motivated me. And then I went off to get a degree in philosophy and basically put a lot of that more practical background sort of on the shelf for a few years, and then studied philosophy. I can say more about the development there and how it started to merge later too. But that was really formative for me because I continued with activism throughout graduate school and philosophy. Mm-hmm. But in so doing, also started to guide a lot of my philosophical questioning toward sort of away from more conventional or traditional philosophical questions and more towards sort of practical or applied policy mechanisms that I thought were sort of underexplored by philosophers.
Okay. So, yeah. So one of the things that you, you start out the book, putting forward a view that I take to be the dominant view, let's say among environmentalists, that you have that part of what motivates us to act, in environmentally friendly ways is the idea that nature is good, that nature has value, either intrinsic or extrinsic. And there's this connection between between action of a certain sort and the idea that we should do it because nature itself has some sort of value.
Right.
And one of the criticisms the people who are, I don't know if you want to call them anti-environmentalists, but those who will make fun of the environmental movement in terms of tree huggers or
right.
people who embrace the pygmy owl in the Pacific Northwest at the cost of human jobs and basically kind of make fun of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you make the point early on, before you kind of get to the more Kantian stuff mm-hmm. later on, that you don't need to love nature to be motivated to protect it.
Right.
And I just wanted you to start out maybe with basically the way you start out in the book, which is, gently criticizing this dominant position in the environmentalist movement of trying to motivate action by showing that nature is good or that it has a certain value or something like that, because you want to distinguish, as you do numerous ways throughout the book, between the good and the right, which is, of course, a standard basic distinction in ethical theory. But
yep.
you're applying that to this particular case of the what to do in environmental ethics as opposed to, say, some other area of moral theory. So could you explain a bit about that view that you're opposing?
Sure. That's a very funny way of putting it. I like what you say, and I appreciate that you said that I was being gentle, because I will tell you that I've had a lot of readers of this book, and some of them they sort of bristle at my use of terminology like tree hugger or tree hugging dirt worshiper or something like that. And they think that I'm not being gentle in any way, right? That I'm just being this kind of crass, anti-environmentalist myself. So some fingers are pointing at me for those reasons. But frankly, I mean, a lot of the time when I'm talking about tree huggers or hippies, I'm talking about myself. I mean, I'm talking about my friends and people that I love and care about dearly, and I've worked closely with. But ultimately, I'm responding also to them and writing this book in a way for them, because in my experience, the foregone conclusion within environmentalism and maybe even within a lot of activist communities, even outside of environmentalism, is that if you can demonstrate the value of something, in one way or another, then the mere demonstration of that value will be enough to either motivate people to take action or at least to demonstrate that some obligation follows from the demonstration of the value. So, if you can show that nature is provides us with some kind of services, or that nature is, you know, intrinsically valuable in its own right, or that it is sentimentally valuable for you, then presumably there is some kind of imperative that follows from that. And first of all, I mean, I think that's a questionable position. You know, just I think most philosophers will recognize that to be a fairly questionable position. But second of all, I mean, I think that from the standpoint of, I guess one might say most people, it's not the case that all experiences with nature, you know, however construed, play out such that there's a lot to love there. There certainly is a lot to love about nature. And, you know, I live in Colorado. It's a beautiful state, and there's a lot of really fantastic things that one can do here. But if we're not careful, right, nature can come back and harm us you know, destroy our house, or we can get in trouble on a camping trip or what have you. All this to say, basically, nature is wonderful and fantastic, but it's not a clear question as to what the source of nature's value is. And I just think, as a sort of a putative Kantian, that this orientation towards demonstrating the value is not the right path for identifying maybe the source of our obligation. So that's really what motivates this. I'm motivated partly for sort of my theoretical reasons, but I'm motivated also because I feel like a lot of people that I know, you know, a little bit outside of the environmental movement, and maybe I'll use my wife as an example here, don't have this kind of this natural, one might say, they aren't naturally drawn to love camping, mm-hmm. let's say, or aren't naturally drawn to want to wander into the wilderness, right, and just stare at the squirrels in the trees for a long time. We can do it, but most of us would, or many people would rather sort of sit around and have a bowl of popcorn and drink a beer or chat with one another. There are a lot of things to love about that too. So that's kind of why I push this direction. Yeah.
Well, from a broader perspective, is the tree hugging or the do-gooder or those sorts of dominant views towards environmental activism, is it just that they just don't motivate us enough, or is there something deeper, more deeply problematic with their position?
Well, I think there's something very deeply problematic with the position. I think, and we can get into that maybe later, but I think first of all, there are a lot of different audiences that have to be sort of addressed here. But I think broadly speaking, the sort of the more consequentialist orientation of many environmentalists, which is kind of the presumed natural position, I think, of many environmentalists, but also many environmental ethicists. Uh-huh. And they're a different beast, really, environmental ethicists. And many of them, many environmental consequentialists are close friends of mine. So, you know, I address them in more professional contexts. But let me first just talk about sort of like what we call naive consequentialists within the environmental community. Sort of the naive consequentialist in the environmental community is drawn to this idea that simply pointing out the devastating impacts of such and such a policy or the devastating impacts of removing something valuable in nature will be enough to sort of motivate people to subscribe to a policy. I think this is a sort of a rough road to go down, in as much as it's an empirical question in some cases as to whether or not that policy is going to bring about a bad state of affairs. So, for instance, we find a lot of people who sort of are outside of the philosophy community who subscribe to this view that the demonstration of something called ecosystem services, which is the idea that basically ecosystems or natural systems provide us with some kinds of benefits that otherwise go unaccounted for. Mm-hmm. In a way that, like in the production of goods and services, let's say, and these folks who are sort of advocates of this ecosystem services view think that that this will naturally lead us to sort of give greater attention to or to promote nature in a way that takes these kinds of ecosystem services into account. But the fact is, it's an empirical matter, in part. as to whether or not these services are actually provided by nature. And it turns out to be true also that in many cases, industry can provide those services maybe even better than nature itself. For instance, water purification is a great case. You know, we often talk about the drainage of water off of hillsides and into wetland areas as a sort of like an ecosystem service in which the water is purified through filtration systems and whatnot. But as it happens, I mean, there are a lot of pathogens that develop through this process as well, and we're much better at doing it, though it's a little bit more expensive. By building water sanitation facilities and whatnot. So I think this is a dangerous line to go down for naive consequentialists, and we can talk about more sophisticated consequentialists if you'd like, either now or later.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, the basic idea is pretty clear. You know, if we can't know what the consequences are going to be, and furthermore, if we humans can take care of the problem even better than nature, then what's the problem, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I
put it with my students. I say, like, you know, there's a reason we're teaching class here in a building. And that's that, you know, as far as reliable climates are concerned, this building has a fairly reliable climate. That's not true about the quad outside where we would be sitting in the rain or sitting in the freezing cold or in the snow, you know,
right.
A simple way of putting the point.
Right. Well, I think a larger issue, and this comes out kind of throughout the book, the idea of consequences. We don't really know what the consequences of climate change will be, or whether we can control it or anything like that. And that has been a hindrance to adopting some sort of a coherent climate change policy.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I haven't really thought about it like that. I don't know how to pick that apart, but I do make a point similar to that, and I make this point fairly early in the book. And that's that, you know, if we simply, or I make it often with my class as well, and for whatever reason, this seems to open some eyes. But I sort of say, like, look, you know, if it were determined by a bunch of scientists here at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is just up the road in Boulder, if it were determined by just a bunch of climate scientists that climatic change would be good for humanity, let's say, or good for the planet overall, and we could sort of make that determination, is there any sense that any of us would have that we should do something to accelerate climate change, that we should, like, burn a bunch of tires and oil in barrels? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that that follows from the mere observation that climate change would be good for us. And I try to be very clear that I don't think that climate change will be good for us or for the planet. But the point, I think, stands counterfactually that it's not clear that we should do something to accelerate climate change if climate change is going to end up being good for us. And equally so, I'm not clear that the reason we ought to address climate change is only because it's going to bring about catastrophic consequences. Anyway.
Right. Okay. So about in the middle of the book, roughly, mm-hmm. you build your case slowly, so I'm not sort of picking on every single step. But
yeah.
One of the main issues that you, or points that you make, and it's important for your eventual Kantian position, is where you distinguish, humans who have this capacity for reasoning, and for, most importantly, I think, acting for reasons, from, or at least reasons that are in principle justifiable. So the emphasis there on sort of rational justification versus, you know, acting for brute reasons or maybe for no reason. And that distinguishes, you know, humans from other animals. And I was just wondering if you could say a bit more about that distinction. It's traditional. It's sanctioned by intuition in a lot of ways.
Right.
But it also strikes me as a little bit like, well, you know, we're finding out an awful lot about, you know, the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
The lines between, you know, what's exclusively human and what's not are kind of blurring, at least in some ways. Maybe maybe we're not ready to kind of erase them, but in any case, it struck me as something that ought to be given more defense than you actually give it in the book. And that may just be because there wasn't any necessity in the context of the book to do it. But since it does play an important role, I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on this distinction, or if you even need the distinction as such, rather than just, hey, we have this capacity to reason and that's good enough.
Okay, that's a really great question. I like the way you put it. But before I answer it, I want to sort of like preface by explaining a bit about the nature of the book and the audience for the book, because I think that's important here.
Okay.
This is and I know you know this because I know you've read the book. The book is clearly it's not written like a sort of a standard scholarly academic text. I wrote it intending to appeal to readers of serious nonfiction. So these are the kind of the Steven Pinker style books in which there's a fairly casual treatment of a lot of really difficult issues in an attempt to make those issues interesting and compelling, but also approachable, right? So a lot of what I do throughout the book is I kind of gloss pretty big issues, right? That could be taken up in a class, a class completely dedicated to those issues, right? So, for instance, I use the term nature extremely loosely throughout the book, without addressing, all the various different definitions of nature that appear throughout the environmental philosophy literature or the history of philosophy. And so too is that the case with this distinction between humans and animals. It seems to me that we can just kind of build off of this general intuition that there is something about humans that distinguishes them from what might be more broadly characterized as non-human animals. I don't recognize this expressly in the book, but I obviously would want to distinguish. I would want to say, like, sure, there are many non-human animals who appear to offer up something like reasons. Are they ultimately reasons responsive entities, in the way that like you or I am? Are there not marginal cases of humans who have who are not reasoners? There are definitely these kinds of marginal cases. And in fact, the line between sort of human and non-human animals and reasoning and non-reasoning beings is considerably blurrier than I make it out to be. But I mean, that was kind of a strategic decision on my part, and maybe just a kludge to try to push in the direction of talking about reason all around, and to get at the reasoning nature of essentially moral actors. So, I mean, if it turns out to be the case that dolphins and great apes also offer up reasons and are responsive to them and can endorse principles, then I think there's a sense in which we can both hold them responsible and maybe even expect them to respond or reason with us. There's a second part of your question that I want to address also regarding the necessity of pointing to the bruteness of some reasons or the animal nature of humans. There's for at least the second half of the book, maybe the last quarter of the book, I spend a good bit of time talking about the way in which humans often guide their actions simply by appeal to their drives or their motivations. Maybe it is the whole second half of the book, actually. And specifically in the last quarter of the book, I spent some time trying to suggest that, or at least I try to make this clear, I'm not sure how successful I am, that so much of our contemporary sort of commercial apparatus, that is to say our economy, is built around this idea that we can, provided that we have all appropriate rights assigned, property rights, we can make decisions that more or less fulfill our wants and desires, right? And that's the purpose of our exchange economy. We have a bunch of dollars in our pocket and we can spend them as we wish, right? Provided that, we abide by the laws, but also that we have property rights. I think this is devastating for the environment, right? This unreflective freedom to simply act according to our wants and desires. And I think the environment would be much better off, and I think we would be much better off as a civilization and society if we would not only act according to our wants and desires, but reflect a bit on our acts and desires and ask whether or not they were appropriate, whether they're respectful, whether they could be justified to a community of other like reasoners. That is ultimately the objective of the book. So I think I want to drag us away from this kind of animalistic, brute-ish orientation towards fulfilling our wants and desires.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. So let me press a bit on this, because this does play an enormous role, obviously, given the Kantian orientation of the book. And so we can, it's true. So let's just accept, you know, we do have this capacity for reasoning, where reason's responsive. We don't just act by brute reasons, whatever dolphins do or don't do.
Yeah.
But we do it sometimes and in very limited circumstances, or at least that's sort of what psychology is telling us.
Right.
And so here's the problem. You want to reorient environmentalism towards a view where we are motivated to act in environmentally friendly ways, based on, you know, reasoning rather than our wants and desires or some other, or because nature's good and we love it or something.
Right.
But our capacity for reasoning is kind of limited, and we don't do it. We actually don't do it very well. I mean, in a sense,
right?
ideally, you know, yeah. And Kant is very much an idealizer of human nature, human rationality, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about ideal reasoners here. We're talking about real people who respond pretty much to kind of what's in front of them.
Right.
And don't have a good sense of how to reason about things that are happening maybe farther than a week away. I mean, it can be difficult. And this is particularly the case that comes up over and over again in discussions of climate change, where you know, even if we don't know exactly what the consequences are going to be, or we don't know what technological fixes we can come up with, there's still this big gap in terms of our ability to motivate ourselves by reasoning, you know, what's a plausible scenario in terms of the outcomes of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And our ability to actually get that to motivate ourselves here and now to, you know, stop buying those gas-guzzling cars or vote for new taxes that will, you know, might be a few bucks per person, but will improve, I don't know, some sort of transportation for everybody, various things that we just over and over have been found unable to do,
right,
unable to act on, even though reason does tell you that these seem to be the right things to do, you know, plausibly.
Right.
So how do you overcome that sort of natural, the built-in limitations of human reason, given your Kantian perspective?
Okay, so yeah, I should now maybe even clarify what that Kantian perspective is a bit more.
Okay.
So I think I am better characterized as a Kantian in sort of name only or in heritage. I sort of, studying philosophy and writing my dissertation and so on, I wrote on Rawls and Habermas and Korsgaard. And so, these are contemporary Kantians,
yeah,
who are operating in the Kantian tradition, but ultimately they're considerably more aware of, you know, the sort of contemporary psychological debates and discussions about the passions and the drives, and all of them to greater or lesser degree, and not just these three, but of course other figures as well, Scanlon and Darwall and other sort of folks operating within this body of literature, are aware of the limitations of reason, I think, in a way that, you know, Kant was a little bit more idealistic. And I sort of agree with a lot of the more contemporary Kantians, like these folks, that we can't serve as our own guides, right? Or we as reasoning agents aren't reasonable enough to serve as our own guides, but we have to subject our reasons to, you know, public testing of some sort. And I should say, in agreeing broadly with this community of authors in the philosophy literature, that I am agreeing very broadly with them, right? I mean, I think the more sort of difficult meta-ethical discussions in which they're engaged heatedly are very, very interesting. But I want to remain agnostic about sort of like the ultimate nature of justificatory reasons or nature of internal or externalism. I don't want to sort of come down one way or the other on that because I think as important as those debates are, they're not as important to the main issue that I want to address, which is what reasons have we for being environmentalists, or what reasons have we to look beyond our own sets of concerns to care for or to promote or protect the natural environment or the health and well-being of others. So I think that's my primary objective there, is to be cognizant of the fallible nature of us as reasonable, mm-hmm. as reasoning beings, and to try to check this fallible nature with a kind of a public test. Now, you mentioned also briefly the sort of problems that we, I guess you mentioned two things. Maybe I can return to the motivation question in a second. But you also mentioned this kind of like the way in which reason even fails at the institutional level. And I think actually when you're talking about climate change, you were saying that it's a lot of our climate policy isn't made in a way that seems to be reasonable or rational. I think that's actually less true. I mean, than it is at the individual level. I mean, I think that at least my observation seems to be that institutions can function more reasonably, right, in a way than individual actors. And though it may be the case that some institutions do respond to, you know, the interests of the institution that is more or less making a decision, it's very often the case that by the nature of the organization of an institution, whatever it may be, like say it's the UNF3C, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or all of the subsidiary bodies underneath the UNF3C, these are agencies that seek to arrive at some kind of agreement that will work for all affected parties. And I think they do this in part by making appeals to one another about sort of the right course of action. What we also find when we have these major international negotiating bodies, this is true at the UNF3C negotiating conferences known as the Council Party Meetings, the COPs, also true with fisheries management negotiations when we're talking about international fisheries. What we find is we have these international bodies that often are also drawn to argue strictly from the standpoint of national self-interest, right? And I think this is a problem. I think they should not be arguing from the standpoint of national self-interest. They should be arguing from sort of the general interest, right? Like what is ultimately going to help to facilitate the health and well-being of a fishery, or facilitate the health and well-being of the planet, let's say in the case of climate change. And so part of the organization of the book is to not just attend to the sort of the failures of reason on the part of the individual, but also to attend to the failures of reason on the part of institutions and institutional negotiations. That doesn't play a front and center role, but I mention it, I think, throughout. And that's in the back of my mind.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you also, you do a nice, you call the whole issue of climate change a colossal tragedy of the commons, which I thought was very apt. Your argument, I mean, this sort of builds on what you just said. You argue that there is hope in the sense that given by figures such as Eleanor Ostrom, political scientist or economist, whatever.
Very important person.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That we can arrive at, you know, despite all the fallible nature of human reasoning, we can arrive at communal principles that do ensure, that do bring about a kind of self-regulation, as opposed to, you know, the original tragedy of the commons, Garrett Hardin, who was pretty pessimistic about, you know, it's like, well, we can't overcome this problem, and it just, we're inevitably headed to ruin.
Right.
So maybe you can explain a bit about the problem of climate change from this aspect of resolving the problem of the tragedy of the commons.
Sure, I can give that a shot. A few things to say on that. I think the tragedy of the commons is for me a very vexing problem, and not just because it's vexing because we don't know how to respond to it. There are a bunch of sort of economic and game theoretic responses to the tragedy of the commons, but I think it's vexing in part because it's not ultimately clear from simply reading explanations of the tragedy of the commons what the tragedy is. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it would appear that it's some kind of devastation or destruction of value, or something of value, like a fishery or a grazing plot, to take the sort of the two common explanations. But I also think there's a sense in which the tragedy of the commons is more aptly described as a case in which individual actors acting in their own self-interest fundamentally undercut their own self-interest, and so are essentially self-sabotaging. And that may be ultimately what the tragedy is, that they're self-sabotaging. Folks like the Ostromites, Eleanor Ostrom, and many of my colleagues here at Colorado and at the University of Arizona. I worked with a student of Eleanor Ostrom when I was at Arizona. Put a lot of faith in Eleanor's and their own observations that people do form non or informal mechanisms, sanctioning mechanisms for a governing action that will then resolve tragedies of the commons, particularly at local or smaller scale levels. But I think that a lot of the sanctioning that Eleanor Ostrom describes is not well accounted for. Ultimately what those kinds of sanctions consist in, or what those kinds of rules consist in, or what gives rise to them. And I think there's a moral story to be told about those rules. I think, and I guess I kind of have an intuition that at the end of the day, it boils down to something like, you're not respecting me, a claim of local actors to one another that, like, you know, I have an interest here. And then another person, you know, who is also a part of that community of people who are sort of using the commons for their own benefit, recognizes that their friend is not being respected, or the friend also has a need that needs to be responded to. And in as much as that's the case, a norm emerges from that. That's a fairly simple explanation, but seems not unreasonable to me. Anyway, so onto the question of voting. I use that example basically to address this issue of something like causal impotence, or what's sometimes called causal impotence, because I think we encounter with many environmental problems the conundrum that many of our actions are not actions that will in any respect benefit us. In fact, may be the kinds of things that are difficult for us to do or hard to engage, like voting. It's very hard sometimes to go out and vote, or even to learn all the stuff that we need to learn to bring ourselves up to speed to the point at which we can vote intelligently. And I think we can probably all agree to that. It seems to be difficult. I mean, there are a lot of responses to the problem of causal impotence within the philosophy literature. Some are very formal, very complicated calculations about averaging out, impacts or what have you. But my thought is, and it's not an unfamiliar thought. It's not an idea that I can claim credit for. But I think it's an important one, that one of the reasons we ought to be voting has nothing to do with whether or not our vote is going to make a difference, right? The reason why we ought to vote is because we are citizens and members of a state in which, there's an expectation what it means to be a citizen is that we are the kinds of beings that vote. So I think that's true also about being a citizen of the environment. I think we're the kinds of beings who are responsive to our environment and are not the kinds of beings who can just kind of do with nature as we wish.
Yeah. Well, before I wanted to press the analogy a bit of voting, but before I get that, I do want to ask, should we think of human population or overpopulation as another kind of tragedy of the commons?
I mean, that's tricky. Human population. A lot of environmental issues like this could be understood as a kind of tragedy of the commons, particularly if we place a pre-specified value or a baseline or target on a state of the world, right? And a lot of the book is oriented around trying to push us away from or to move us away from thinking about state of the world talk. If we think that there is some ideal population or optimal population that can be specified by, carrying capacity, or that can be specified by something like, overall happiness, I think we might be inclined to think that population is a kind of tragedy of the commons that needs to be rectified or addressed. On the other hand, people have children and families are an important part of living on this planet. And it's not clear that that we're correct to characterize the having of a child by two parents or more parents as playing into, I guess, what you might think of as this global or colossal tragedy of the commons, this overpopulation. That doesn't seem to me the right level at which to address this so-called issue of population. That's not a very intelligent response I just gave you, but it is an attempt to take a stab at that issue. I think a lot of environmental issues can be understood as something like a tragedy of the commons, but in a way, this characterization of environmental problems, it seems to me, misses some important dimensions of those problems. And in the case of population, what it misses is the human dimension of having a child, right?
Right. But I guess what the kind of question behind that is, mm-hmm. for many people, having a child is not very clearly a sort of rational process in which one kind of decides. I mean, one is not a Kantian in these sorts of decisions, and yet.
Right.
One's decisions about whether or not to have children have extremely important consequences, are not causally impotent in terms of the larger picture. And it's clearly a part of the problem in terms of climate change. It's not just burning fossil fuels. It's also taking over land, territory, and so forth, and you know, crowding out other species, and or having many people in places that the environment as such can't necessarily sustain very well. You know, water resources, and as you mentioned at the start of the interview, right?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it boils down to resource problems. So I'm just kind of wondering how the Kantian, you know, rational perspective ought to play out for that decision, which very clearly does have consequences, bad consequences for the environment. How do you get the, if you can't get rationality there?
Yeah.
That seems to be leaving out a pretty big issue. It's not just rationality about, you know, should I buy this carton of organic eggs versus this other one? And it's not just, should I buy this gas guzzler or this, you know, leaf?
Yep.
But, you know, should I have children or should I maybe adopt, you know, somebody from a different part of the world? And that would be a very rational thing to do.
Yeah, sure. No, that's a great question, and that helps me understand ultimately why you were asking that question. I think sort of our natural inclination, particularly in the environmental community, is to think about essentially the footprint of our actions and to ask these questions about whether it makes sense for me to have a child, given that there are so many children who are needy, there are so many orphan children, so many. You know, the population is exploding. I think in a way that this is where the Kantian has a leg up on the sort of the stricter consequentialist or utilitarian even.
Oh, good.
And that's that. I think. I mean, in that. You know, I mean, both the Kantian and the utilitarian are going to be asking for something like a justification as to what counts as a reasonable course of action. And the utilitarian is going to answer something like, you know, you should try to minimize your damaging footprint however you possibly can. And this is going to require some very significant cutbacks on action, including conceivably, you know, not having children. As it happens, it probably is the most ecologically, environmentally important decision that any person will make in their life, whether to have a child or not. I mean, that's going to have the greatest impact of anything else that they do. Just by virtue of bringing another person on board, you know, it consumes a lot of resources. But I also think that, as I was trying to say before, kind of ham-handedly, there's a very important human dimension to having, in a way, the autonomy or the freedom to build a family. This is not to say that building a family is for everybody. Maybe you can choose not to do that. But I think that the Kantian, or the more broadly the deontologist, is going to at least try to say, like, you know, within some range of actions, we can set constraints on actions, right? It's maybe not reasonable for you to have 10 kids, right? Or like overdo it with kids, but within some range of actions, having a kid or not having a kid is part of the human experience. And it may be the case that we're going to have to live with a moderately degraded environment by virtue of this feature of humanity, that this is just kind of who we are, that our lives are sometimes enriched by having the freedom to bring other life on board, or to maybe even to adopt children, right? Or whatever our decisions are. I think that compels me, the idea of putting constraints on action, but not forcing us into a sort of a very narrow, small footprint, difficult, maybe extensively difficult and demanding position, like we might get out of utilitarianism. I don't think the demandingness objection applies as aggressively to the deontologists as it does to the utilitarians. But maybe I I could be corrected.
I don't know. I mean, it's to me, it's kind of a central problem in the Kantian perspective, given the fact that, well, as you put it, you know, having children, what have you, is part of the human experience. But, you know, obviously the same thing can be said, and autonomy. It's the same thing, you know, somebody who doesn't want to do the things that you think or that many people think are the right thing to do with regard to the environment might simply say something along the same lines, that, you know, this is part of, you know, my human experience or the human experience, or who gets to say, right, what is part of the human experience or not.
Well, this is where the publicity of reasons is going to have to play a role, right? I mean, I think we're going to have to ask these questions. It just doesn't seem to me reasonable that we could say, you know, of all parents, that they're effectively environmental criminals, right? Or they're doing something, you know, catastrophic for nature, for the globe. It doesn't seem that that's the kind of thing that I could get a bunch of people to assent to, because it's such an important part of the human experience. That is, it seems to me, right? Whereas I don't know. I mean, you know, again, this has got to be hashed out, I guess, in some way. It seems to me that the consequentialists are going to be in a much trickier position with regard to this question, because, you know, there the mandate is to try to minimize negative impacts wherever possible. And that will put people in a position of basically being bad actors, you know, if they make decisions that don't involve driving a Leaf, as you said, mm-hmm. or having a child, you know, or having a child, you know, I don't know.
Okay.
It's a tricky, I mean, I could go on for a long time about this. It's a very tricky question.
Yeah.
But of course, I feel like there's some permission, that, you know, this is about permissions in a way, and we have some permission to live lives in a way that is enriching for us. Not feel as though we've completely sort of run off the rails with regard to the environment.
Right. And many hunters will.
Right.
Equally, right. You know,
I hear you.
Hunting is like enriching human experience. In fact, it goes back to hunter gatherer, and it's just part of being human.
Yeah. It's a great point. I mean, you know, right. So this is always going to be a problem, though. It's a problem within philosophy and outside of philosophy. We're always going to have people who make these kinds of appeals to things that we've always done. But I think, you know, the case of hunting is a challenging one. I think it's much easier to say to a hunter, right, let's not take hunting writ large, right? But let's just take something like, you know, say as a big game hunter who wants to hunt an endangered species, right? I think there are a lot of reasons that can be offered up to a hunter, or even the use of lead bullets, right? You say, like, you know, you don't really need to use lead bullets to achieve this objective of yours, which is to get some kind of glory and some excitement by walking into the wilderness and shooting creatures. There are a lot of other activities that can play that role. And so it seems to me reasonable to allow or permit the use of lead bullets, right, for a hunter, or more broadly, to allow hunters to go hunt an endangered wolf, right? That doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would pass a kind of public test, right, in quite the same way that allowing parenthood would pass a test. I mean, I recognize, of course, that this is sticky, right, because, you know, historical contingencies being what they are, you might end up in a historical period where, you know, everybody's a kind of a bloodthirsty meat eater, and what they want to do is just walk into the wilderness and shoot lead bullets and shoot endangered species. That certainly could be the case. And this is the downside of pushing for these kind of public reasonableness criteria. But I do sort of believe that the sort of the arc of history is long, you know, and that, you know, if given enough time, we can kind of push ourselves in the direction of saying, this is maybe not acceptable, and this is a little bit more acceptable. I don't know. Maybe okay. I'm an idealist.
Yeah. Well, at the very end of the book, I do want to, we're close to running out of time here. So you've mentioned a couple times this idea of agreement among concerned parties and the publicity and the idea that your reasons are not just that you can give some sort of a reason, but that the reasons have to be in some sense public and agreed upon and all the concerned parties. So it's also this Kantian universalizability, basically, sort of idea in which we can overcome the tragedy, the various tragedies of the commons by providing our reasons to others around us and coming to some sort of agreement among ourselves. And then our actions will be acceptable to a wide range of people. And this is how we overcome the tragedy, through these communally negotiated self-regulations of some sort. Can you say a bit about how you just mentioned you're kind of an idealist. Obviously, today we're in a situation where there is the idea of agreement just seems like such an ideal about climate change, even about just restrictions on who can dump what into Lake Erie and you know, things that we thought were done deals are not done deals anymore. How do you see your prescription for addressing environmental problems generally, and climate change is the big one, but not for everybody. How do you see your program playing out in the current political context, in reality, as opposed to what we ought to do?
Okay, so it's a really, really tricky question, and this may not be a particularly satisfactory answer, but I'll try to give it anyway. I think, first of all, it's important to understand that I understand the book as a call to become more philosophical, and that may be that's true no matter what your ethical, you know, commitments are, right? Whether it's consequentialist or deontological or virtue ethicist or pragmatist or what have you. I think that I'm really asking people to be more reflective about their actions and to subject their reasons and their positions to the scrutiny of essentially their neighbors, but really to think philosophically and deeply about the reasons that they have for taking actions. I think that what we can do as a community is try to build channels for greater public discourse. And of course, you know, you and I are lucky in that we are situated in robust, well-funded, or reasonably well-funded universities with outlets for discussion, and we have access to students who are eager to learn, and we can get into a classroom environment where there's kind of more or less unfettered discourse. These are kind of idealized speech situations. I would like to see more of these publicly. I think our political discourse, I mean, you know, it may be a little idealistic, as I said, but I think our political environment is such that we are not engaging in the way that we engage at the university. And I think this is a real shame. And I think even what's so frustrating to liberal activists and maybe even conservative activists, that the discussions are simply not happening, right? The environment in which we currently live, what we're experiencing now, is essentially just a pulling and tugging of various interests and various kind of like tribal affiliations that is anti-discursive. If there's anything that we can do, and I don't really have a solution for this. I mean, again, like I'm in a lot of my talks, I say this, but I'm just a philosopher. I don't have any practical solutions for this, but I think build the channels, however possible, for greater, increased, more intelligent discourse. That's really what we need to do, both at the individual level and at the institutional level. I don't I don't want to be, I mean, just as one last tip here, I don't want to suggest that, you know, we should just go like right next door and knock on our neighbor's door and say like, let's sit down and have a cup of tea and have a discussion about something you don't want to have a discussion about. I don't mean that at all. I mean that we need to take away obstructions in the public policymaking process and in our individual decision-making process that prohibit us from having these discussions. And so as a final kind of example, I'll bring up a case that I bring up in the book, which is the sort of attempts over the past 30 years or so, and we're going to see them again, to undermine essentially the core directives of the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act, apart from ultimately what it aims to do, which is not just protect species, but also designate habitat, one of the directives of the Endangered Species Act, the way it's written, is to identify initially endangered or threatened species in the world, right? So this is fundamentally a fact-finding act. First and foremost, there's a priority placed on figuring out what is endangered or threatened in the world, what critters are or plants. And there have been attempts to suggest that this is upside down and backwards, that instead what should happen first is we should make a determination about the benefits to America of doing so, right? We should determine whether or not it's going to be cost effective or the benefits are going to be great enough for us to try to preserve or save a species. This seems to me completely backwards, right? We should not base our science on whether or not it's going to be possible from a cost perspective to protect the species. We need to first figure out if a species is endangered or threatened. It seems to me, then make a determination about where the critical habitat is, and then make a determination about whether and how to most cost effectively preserve that habitat or conserve that habitat. That seems to me a case where dialogue has got to enter first, and then cost benefit considerations should enter after the dialogue has happened. We see the opposite happening now in our current political state. So I'd like to see those kinds of efforts upended.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, so I'd like to close with a usual question about what's next for you. Are you pursuing some of the themes in this book, or have you turned to different issues entirely?
No, I have not turned to different issues entirely. I'm one of a few lone voices in the environmental ethics community, kind of pushing a more deontological position. It's a minority position, and it's a difficult one to argue for reasons that you've, I think, nicely and charitably brought out in this discussion. So thank you for that. But I'll probably stick to my position and double down on the deontological stance. I guess it's kind of fun to do that. What I'm currently working on, I was kind of motivated, as much of a headache as it was to get this book published, I've been motivated to write another book. So I'm working on essentially a book that addresses more virtue-oriented positions, the second leading stance within the environmental ethics literature is an environmental virtue ethics. And so I think I might just take my lumps and maybe see about going that direction and see if I can address a few concerns of the virtue ethicists. So that's kind of the project I'm starting up now. I'm not sure if I'm getting into hotter water than I want to be getting into, but that's what I'm doing.
Right. Well, I appreciate your taking the time to talk on New Books in Philosophy today about the wild and the wicked. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks so much, Carrie, for your thoughtful questions.
Okay, and good luck with your work to come.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Benjamin Hale, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. We've been talking about his new book, The Wild and the Wicked on Nature and Human Nature, which is just out from the MIT Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.